Loco and Key. Every one of them is longing to be free. Too many prisoners slave to pleasure and gold. Don't even know it's pleasing. I'm bound to the went home. Down by the change of ignorance, victimized by circumstances, forgive law and justice blind. The history of magical love.
Listening to CFRC 101.9 FM and streaming online at CFRC.ca. This is CPR, CFRC's prison radio program, which airs every Wednesday from 7 to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on your little community campus radio station in Kingston. But our signal extends to Brockville, Belleville, Smiths Falls, and Watertown, New York, if you're lucky. We feature every week news, interviews, writing, and documentaries about prisoners and prison issues. Content is produced right here in our studios and at other campus and community radio stations, including CKUT Montreal and Vancouver Co-op Radio. And the last show every month, we feature calls from home, sharing letters, emails, voice messages, and music requests by and for prisoners and their loved ones. Our radio signal goes to Millhaven, Collins Bay, Joyceville, Bath, the Quinte Detention Center, and Cape Vincent Correctional Facility. And we always want to hear from you, our listeners. So if you've got something to share with us, please email us, cfrcprisonradio@riseup.net. That's cfrcprisonradio, all one word, @riseup.net. You can call us, 613-329-2693, or phone the station at 533-2121 and leave a message. And you can write to us, which is probably the best way to get a hold of us, although it is the slowest, CPR, care of CFRC at Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario, K7L3N6, that's Kilo 7 Lima 3 Narwhal 6. I'll read this out throughout the show as well. We also have a Facebook group, CPR Kingston, and that is also our Twitter handle. Again, if you have access to the internet, those are good ways to get in touch with us. On tonight's program, we're really excited to bring you a fairly extensive interview with Lisa Gunther, the new Queen's National Scholar in Political Philosophy and Critical Prison Studies. But we'll get to that in a moment. I wanted to open with a few headlines here. So first up, we have a story that just broke yesterday from CBC and now through Vice about women prison guards who allege sexual assault and waterboarding my male colleagues. This is Rachel Brown in Vice magazine writing about it and saying that four current and former prison guards at a maximum security federal facility in Edmonton, the Edmonton Institution, we've been talking a lot about the massive dysfunction going on at that institution, which is not atypical for maximum securities. Those four former prison guards and current ones will have filed a $43.4 million lawsuit containing accusations of violent behavior by male colleagues, including sexual assault and waterboarding. A statement of claim filed with the court, filed against the Union of Canadian Correctional Officers and obtained by CBC News, paints a disturbing picture of life inside the Edmonton institution that has previously been accused of fostering a toxic work environment rife with intimidation and inappropriate conduct among staff. And as always, I like to add parenthetically, it can't be great for the inmates either if the staff can't even treat themselves decently. One woman identified under the pseudonym of Andrea alleges a male colleague handcuffed her to a chair using her own restraint and threatened to sexually assault her, while another woman referred to as Jessica claims she was sexually harassed daily at work. The other two women were given pseudonyms as well due to the nature of law enforcement work, the document cited by CBC states. None of the accusations have been proven in court. Requests for comments sent to the Correctional Service of Canada by Vice and CBC have gone unanswered. Jessica further alleges in the lawsuit that two male superiors assaulted her by waterboarding her and laughing about it, as well as choking her and throwing her up against a wall. Like Andrea, Jessica also alleges that she was handcuffed to a chair. The third woman in the lawsuit, Samantha, states she has been on stress leave after 20 years of working at the facility due to being targeted by other employees for being gay. The Edmund Institution, which can house up to 324 inmates but usually holds more, has long faced accusations of violence among inmates and staff. Canada's Correctional Investigation Unit, led by Ivan Zinger, last year told CBC News that his office regularly receives human rights abuse complaints from the facility. It is shocking. There's no doubt strong intervention is required, which has not happened. And of course, the commissioner is on the way out. Last year, the prison was yet again under fire for multiple accusations of sexual harassment and intimidation by male guards towards women working there. And earlier this year, four employees at the institution were fired after Correctional Service of Canada disciplinary investigation into allegations of bullying and intimidation found that there had been bullying and intimidation. The official statement of the now retired Commissioner Don Head said, "We do not tolerate employee misconduct and all allegations are thoroughly investigated regardless of the source. We are determined to improve the workplace to ensure all employees have the respectful work environment they deserve so they can perform the difficult task that they have each and every day." We'll follow that story as it develops. We've got another story that just broke on the CBC yesterday, titled "Indigenous Groups Release Booklet for Workers in the Criminal Justice System." The booklet is intended to give more context and understanding for those who work in the criminal justice system if they are dealing with Indigenous people. It provides information about the Indigenous groups in Atlantic Canada, a brief history of Indigenous Crown relations and the Indian Act, as well as how generational trauma, such as the residential schools, are still having an effect today. The pamphlet is called "Bringing Balance to the Scales of Justice" and was designed by the Mi'kmaq Confederacy of PEI in partnership with the Elsipogtog Restorative Justice Program in New Brunswick, the Miapukak First Nation in Newfoundland and Labrador, and the Mi'kmaq Legal Support Network in Nova Scotia. It was released last month and is now being distributed to police, court officials, probation officers, judges, and lawyers throughout the Atlantic region. Sherry Bernard, Indigenous Justice Coordinator with the Confederacy, says it's important that systemic issues within the Indigenous community are given a proper historical context, particularly around the residential schools. There are certainly effects that have come from that. In areas of high unemployment, lack of opportunities, lack of education, the increase in lateral violence, increase in isolation, and higher rate of suicide, she said. When you're looking at all of these and how they contribute to an offender, they play a huge role. There are also the issues around child apprehension, like the 60s scoop, the effects that it's had, not just on that one generation, but how it has affected the offender intergenerationally. So those issues come down the line. Bernard said these problems do not disappear with the passing of time alone. The trauma that the parents or grandparents or great-grandparents had experienced comes down through the generations, she said. So the intergenerational trauma, whatever trauma hasn't been resolved from one generation, gets passed down to the next. It also talks a bit about GLADU reports, which are pre-sentencing or bail hearing reports that give recommendations to the court about sentencing and offer insight into the specific background of Indigenous people involved in the justice system. We've talked about them before here on CPR. Bernard said over half of Indigenous people involved with the justice system opt to have a GLADU report. Taking a more contextual approach to criminal justice, she said, would help not only offenders, but the system itself. Identifying whether it's an issue of substance abuse, for example, then addressing that issue, it serves much more of a purpose than sending the person to jail where the issue is not resolved, she said. And that's from a CBC article about Indigenous groups releasing a booklet for workers in the criminal justice system. And finally, for those who might not know, a little more lighthearted story, I suppose, is that we are happy to be celebrating, at least here, and hopefully we'll have an interview to follow this up, the release of an album from Grand Valley Institution near Kitchener called Undisclosed Location, which came out March 8th. If you look up the Pros and Cons program online, you can actually download the album for free. And if you can't, we'll be playing a few of those songs throughout the course of my interview with Lisa Gunther slightly later in the hour. The story I was just reading on CBC, which was put out yesterday by Melanie Ferrier, talks about the success and the spread of this program, and it's quite interesting. It's very different than the album that they made at the Pittsburgh Institution, which is now Joyceville Minimum, and it's really quite exciting. I'm going to let the music speak for itself before we do anything else, but I just wanted to let you know that album Undisclosed Location is out now anonymously from the inmates of the Grand Valley Institution. Okay, so that's the end of our news updates here on CFRC's Prison Radio program. Coming up next, we have a very extensive interview broken up by the music of Undisclosed Location with Lisa Gunther, who is the new Queen's National Scholar in Political Philosophy and Critical Prison Studies. We'll talk a bit about what that means in the interview. She's the author of Solitary Confinement, Social Death and Its Afterlives, and The Gift of the Other, Levinas and the Politics of Reproduction, and co-editor of Death and Other Penalties, Philosophy in a Time of Mass Incarceration, with Jeffrey Adelsberg and Scott Zeman. We'll talk about some of her more recent projects. She's also written articles on the grotesque sovereignty of the U.S. death penalty in the Edinburgh Companion to the Critical Medical Humanities, Critical Phenomenology of Solidarity and Resistance in the 2013 California Prison Hunger Strikes, in the book Body Self Other, The Phenomenology of Social Encounters, and We Charge Genocide, Anti-Black Racism in the United States as Genocidal Structural Violence. She has been a very well-engaged public philosopher, has written and been featured in the New York Times, the Chronicle of Higher Education, the website Aeon, and on CBC's Ideas, talking about solitary confinement here in Canada. Without further ado, I'm going to bring you that interview right now here on CPR, CFRC's Prison Radio program.
Hold numb to the surface, they cannot come. Emotions are refused to let see the light. Block the way for this can't be right. Self-destruction's the route I've taken. Can't handle it, I'd rather feel my bones breaking.
I wish I could turn back in time. I wish I could turn back in time. When I was happy and all was fine. When I was happy and all was fine.
I wouldn't change a damn thing, however. I try to hit free, stay there forever. In due time, it'll overflow and erupt. Hope it's just my life, but let it corrupt. Or end it on a high note, honor thee. Death before misery.
So my name is Cameron, and you're listening to CPR here on CFRC 101.9 FM. And I'm very happy to be joined by Lisa Gunther, who is the new Queen's National Scholar of Political Philosophy and Critical Prison Studies. And I thought I would ask for something. What does that title and role entail?
That's a great question. So when I told people that I was applying for a job in critical prison studies, they were like, oh my God, that's amazing. I feel like that's exactly what I do, but it's not really a thing in the world so much as criminology is, mm-hmm. or sociology. So what I understand by critical prison studies is a study of the history and the politics and the architecture and power dynamics of the prison that does so through a critical lens, that puts in question the very existence or the need for prisons. Although one can engage in critical prison studies as an abolitionist or not, but I think the critical part of critical prison studies is asking questions about the very social function of prisons and whether we can imagine a world beyond prisons or beyond the specific prison system that we have today.
Well put. I think it's important, too, that I don't believe Queens has ever had a scholar of this sort kind of officially appointed, which is a surprise given it's Kingston's long history as a prison city.
It's true, yeah. And so that's what makes this position really exciting for me, because my home discipline is philosophy. I didn't come to thinking about prisons through a sociology or criminology background. I didn't even come to it necessarily through a political philosophy background, but rather through phenomenology, which is kind of an odd way to come at the issue of prisons. So phenomenology is this practice of philosophy that really looks at the way we experience the world and tries to understand what are the basic structures that make that experience possible on a very visceral level. Like, how is it that we perceive objects as three-dimensional objects that stay stable in space when we don't actually see them or perceive them all at once? We have just limited glimpses of an object as we move around it. And so that might seem like it's completely disconnected from anything that has to do with prisons. But the main way that I've brought phenomenology as a philosophical method to my study of prisons is looking at solitary confinement and the way that long-term solitary confinement often produces perceptual distortions in the people who are incarcerated. So they begin to hallucinate or to have a hard time having a stable perception of an object in the world. The boundaries around that object might waver, or patterns in a table or on door might vibrate. And so I became interested in trying to figure out, A, why is it that prolonged isolation would cause these, or tend to produce these perceptual distortions? And also, why do we do this to people if it's a pretty well-documented fact that solitary confinement does produce such perceptual and cognitive and emotional, really detrimental effects in people?
Well, and that's interesting, too. I was just reading a book by Janet Semple about Jeremy Bentham and kind of his plans for the panopticonic prison. And foundationally, at the very beginnings of modern penal design, is this question about solitary confinement, because Bentham... Yes. was horrified by it, but his entire system basically depended upon it at the same time. And it's interesting that we have 250 years of history of critical positions by people who are intimately familiar with it, both inmates and designers, who nonetheless cannot figure a way forward out of it.
Just today, so I'm teaching a class right now in philosophy of law, and I'm doing it as a critical theories of punishment class. Mm-hmm. So today we were talking about Foucault. We've been talking about Foucault for a couple of weeks, but we looked at the chapter in Foucault's Discipline and Punish where he says, you know, from the beginning, the prison was a failure. The prison was a project of reform. It was supposed to be a humane alternative to corporal and capital punishment. So rather than publicly torturing people and executing them or flogging them or shaming them, in the Enlightenment and early modern period, different thinkers, including Bentham, came up with ideas for a reformatory or penitentiary that would respect the, well, Bentham was not super concerned about the human dignity of individuals. He was more interested in maximizing utility. But many other prison reformers were concerned to find some form of punishment that would seem consistent with the principles of liberal democracy. And so rather than destroying people and breaking their bones in public, couldn't we put them in a space where even if they don't feel like they want to repent for the wrongdoing that they've done, even if they don't admit that they've done wrong, we can kind of force them into a sort of penitence. But from the very beginning, the penitentiary failed to produce the results that people like Bentham or like Benjamin Rush, who was one of the architects of the penitentiary system in the U.S., thought that it would produce. And so there was from the beginning this kind of ambivalence about solitary confinement. Like, on one hand, it seemed like this is a great idea because it's touchless. You're not twisting the limbs or lacerating the flesh of people to punish them. You are putting them in a space where that space is designed to try to orient their soul upward towards God and to, in a way, reset their lives. And so Benjamin Rush imagined solitary confinement as a kind of death and resurrection. You put someone in what in the early penitentiary system was like a living tomb, a dark cell where the only light was in the ceiling as a kind of skylight, or what they called God's eye. And you let them be there until they're ready to come out and play nicely. And so even if that was understood by the architects of that system as a kind of humane alternative to torture, it seemed very clear right from the beginning that it was a form of touchless torture. And yet, Foucault points out, every failure of the penitentiary system to produce the docile subjects and the rehabilitated individuals doesn't seem to yield the conclusion that, oh, we should maybe try something else. Rather, the prison is always offered as the solution to the problems of the prison. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the interesting things about that I think a critical perspective on prisons needs to disentangle.
I was reading some Ivan Illich lately, and I'm paraphrasing him, has a problem of a crisis of escalation where
yes.
if it's not working, you simply have to apply more bureaucracy
exactly.
or more different techniques and study it more. It's interesting, too, because I think Bentham, reading through this book, was very aware that the foundational punishment of confinement was the death of the social. And that's
yes.
something you've talked about quite a bit in
right.
research, is that that is the element that, talking about phenomenology, if we understand human relationships as the way we understand the world, then killing that relationship essentially kills something of the person.
Well, and what was it effective at doing? Mm. That's the question. Foucault talks about the goal of the penitentiary system as producing docile subjects, where obedient, hardworking, industrious individuals who did not cause further trouble once you released them. And I guess to some extent, that is one of the products of the penitentiary system. But he also points out the byproduct of the penitentiary system, which is the resistant subject who, you know, we could call in scare quotes delinquent. That's the term that Foucault uses. Basically, those who refuse the program of becoming docile and obedient, but who remain useful to a broader political strategy of maintaining a population of people at the fringes of society. I think when we look at corporate crime or, you know, the sort of criminal activity that leads to many, many deaths in coal mines or in oil and gas extraction industries or in the financial industry, we don't see a lot of people going to prison, even if they have broken the law and committed crimes that have ruined many, many people's lives. And so Bentham's utilitarianism can lend itself to a kind of cynical differentiation between who is it convenient to punish and who is it inconvenient or even difficult to punish mm-hmm. because they already have so much power and they have a certain usefulness within the given social order.
Kate Johnson, the Queen's chaplain, who you may have met, said
yes.
to me once that things like poverty and race and mental illness
yes.
are not determinants of who will commit crime, simply
yes.
who will be caught and punished
exactly.
for them.
I wish I could turn back in time. Wish I could turn back in time. When I was happy and I was fine. When I was happy and I was fine. I wish I could turn.
Concepts of time, and I
yes,
understand that phenomenology
yes.
has some touch on that, but I was rereading Chester Himes, who was a prisoner in the 1930s and wrote a lot of detective novels, and he said that the endless, monotonous, unvarying, unmovingly eternal stretch is how he described incarceration. And Alison Brown has talked about that in her scholarship of the feeling of time stretching out to infinity and yet being compressed. So I'm wondering if, you know, is there a way how we can talk about that in a philosophical way, maybe?
Yes, certainly. I mean, so this is something that a lot of people in prison talk about, the way that it messes with your lived experience of time. And so phenomenology as a philosophical interrogation of the meaning of experience is really interested in the way that we live time in a way that is distinct from clock time or calendar time. So an hour where you are really excited or really afraid even can go by super fast, and an hour where you're bored or where you really wish you were somewhere else can be endless seeming. And this is really, that elasticity of time is something that's a huge issue in prison, especially in the sort of warehouse prisons that have unfortunately proliferated in the late 20th century and into the 21st century, where if the early penitentiary system sought to improve and micromanage people's lives in ways that can be really invasive and patronizing, the warehouse prison doesn't even take that much interest in people. And so people feel like, I'm locked down in this box, and how do I even tell the difference between day and night? Often solitary confinement cells don't have any windows, or they have just a very thin window. From a phenomenological perspective, your body is the root and the site of your lived experience of the world. But your body is a point from which there are multiple openings and multiple horizons that connect you with other people, that connect you with other places. And if your entire days and nights are spent in a box where you have no visual horizon on an outside world, and where you might spend years or even decades in the same space, then that affects your sense of time, but also your sense of identity. Mm-hmm. A lot of people who are in prolonged solitary confinement start feeling like a ghost in their own lives, or like they no longer even feel rooted in their body. And I think phenomenologists can help us to understand what's going on there, especially the work of Merleau-Ponty, this French phenomenologist, who really emphasizes the way in which we make meaning collaboratively with other people. And we do this in complex ways when we have a conversation, but we also do it in really simple ways that are not discursive and that we often don't think about, but that are sort of pre-reflective, where, like, when I walked into this recording studio, you walked around the table, and so did I. And just in the navigation of space, when you see other embodied beings moving around objects, that's just a silent, very implicit confirmation that that object is there for them too, and not just for you. That they're recognizing it and negotiating around it just as you would if you were standing where they are. And that kind of, those feedback loops between my comportment towards the world and my observation of other people comporting themselves towards the same objects from a different point in space helps to weave this fabric of the objective world as a stable place where I can tell the difference between imagining a pink elephant and seeing a stuffed pink elephant, you know, at a fair or something like that. That difference between imagining, remembering, and perceiving can become blurred for people who are in extreme isolation, whether in prison or even in other extreme situations where you no longer in an everyday way share space with other people. The specificity of isolation in prison is that we do this in fairly calculated ways to people. It's not just an accident that supermax cells are very sort of low visual stimulus, gray walls with 24/7 fluorescent lights and few or no windows. those that design was the outcome of research done on sensory deprivation, both in the prison context and in the military context. And designers of prisons in the 20th century have taken a combination of this sensory deprivation research and also, in ways that are really unsettling, prisoner litigation, contesting the cruel and unusual punishment of certain prison conditions as their design sort of briefs. So the way that prisoner litigation, there was a period in the 70s where there was quite a bit of progress in improving prison conditions in the U.S. and in Canada in the wake of some really significant uprisings of people in prison contesting the terrible conditions in which they were being held. As these cases moved through the courts, they established a baseline or a threshold for prison conditions, which is really important, but contemporary prison designers will often take that litigation as not the minimum threshold, but the new normal, and design just to that basic threshold of what the courts have been demonstrated to allow.
That reminds me of things like the Ventura Report, which are a response to those uprisings, and legislation like the McCann case against solitary confinement that then promptly just say, okay, we just need to do it a little bit better.
Right, exactly.
But further isolate the worst prisoners. And you see this kind of escalation of practices in responses to orders, which is why I'm really skeptical whenever I find out about a Supreme Court decision.
Because, right.
You know, the law is one thing, but practice is another, and they don't always agree at a foundational level.
And here again, prison is being offered as the solution to the problem of prison, or even more extreme, but maybe more limited or regulated solitary confinement is being offered as the solution to the problems of solitary confinement.
Suffocating in the darkness, surrounded by old ghosts, locked away in those memories, are all the things that I fear the most. When the sky.
I'm curious about the steps that you may have taken from philosophy into kind of more of an activist stance on solitary confinement. Were you studying, you know, a political philosophy and then got involved in sort of activism around prisons? Or was it sort of just you read it and realized, oh, wait, this thing that I'm doing completely applies to this? And I'm always curious about those moments of like aha-ness.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit of a series of leapfrogging aha moments, if that makes any sense. Yeah. So I started thinking about prisons in a critical way when I moved to the United States. So we have to go back into ancient history, 10 years ago. I moved to the United States for a job, and I had lived in New Zealand for a job for 5 years before that. And so I moved from the land of hobbits and actually a very problematic prison system, but that wasn't really on my radar when I lived in New Zealand. But I moved to the United States where the inequality of race and class was just so starkly in my face every day. I moved to Nashville, Tennessee, and it is a city that is in some ways not more segregated racially than other American cities. It was my first experience of living in a place where from block to block, the configurations of race and class would change dramatically. And I was working at a private university that felt like a plantation, quite frankly. And at this university, Angela Davis, the former political prisoner and political philosopher and author of the book Are Prisons Obsolete, she came for an entire month to do a month-long intensive graduate seminar in our department, the philosophy department. And so I was just really excited to meet Angela Davis and to learn from her. And I also wanted, the topic of her seminar was slavery. And so I thought, this is something I need to learn this history in order to figure out where it is that I've landed in the world and how the space of the city ended up getting divided in such radical ways in terms of race and class. So the seminar that Angela Davis offered was about slavery, but it began with the 13th Amendment, which abolishes slavery and indentured servitude, except for those who have been duly convicted of a crime. And so there's a loophole built into the 13th Amendment for the constitutional enslavement of people who are in prison. And I had no idea that exception existed. I learned so much in that course about the legacies of slavery and of this distinctive form of prison slavery. It was in the midst of all that I started thinking about prisons. Mm. And at first it was just to make sense of where I now lived. But as I read more and more, I thought I wanted to engage with those issues as a philosopher and also as someone who was not yet in any way involved in prison activism, but thought we can't just know these things without trying to do something collectively to transform them. The next few years were a process of learning more about the prison system in the United States. And eventually I started thinking about focusing on solitary confinement in a phenomenological way, just because these testimonies were so rich in their descriptions of the ways in which solitary confinement impacted their lived experience of the world in terms of perception and emotion and the experience of time and space. I met someone who taught philosophy in prison at a conference. Just, you know, it wasn't a conference about prisons, it was about phenomenology, actually. And he put me in touch with someone in Nashville who organized prison education programs. And then I volunteered for that. And it was through this Inside Out program that I then connected with a network of other people who were teaching in prison. And through expanding that network, then connected with prison activists, first nationally and then locally. And it was really through the growth expansion of the Black Lives Matter movement and also conversations about the school-to-prison pipeline that the prison activist community in Nashville really grew and became really powerful and insightful and had a lot of effect on public policy and also just the public perception of prisons and prisoners.
And you're listening to CPR. That's CFRC 101.9 FM's prison radio program, which airs every 7 to 8 p.m. right here on. We're about halfway through our interview with Lisa Gunther, the new Queen's University National Scholar in Political Philosophy and Critical Prison Studies. It's a really far-ranging and broad and intelligent interview. I'm so proud to be bringing this to you. And we talk about a lot of other stuff going forward. If you'd like to hear more interviews like this or interviews about other things, we'd love to hear from you. So here's how you can get a hold of us. Please email us, cfrcprisonradio@riseup.net. That's cfrcprisonradio, all one word, @riseup.net. You can call us, 613-329-2693, or phone the station at 533-2121 and leave a message. And you can write to us, which is probably the best way to get a hold of us, although it is the slowest. CPR, care of CFRC at Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario, K7L3N6, that's Kilo 7 Lima 3 Narwhal 6. I'll read this out throughout the show as well. We also have a Facebook group, CPR Kingston, and that is also our Twitter handle. Again, if you have access to the internet, those are good ways to get in touch with us. All right, and let's get back to that interview with Lisa Gunther right here on CPR, CFRC's prison radio program at 101.9 FM on your radio dial and at cfrc.ca online. Next, I'd like to ask something about more practical aspects, which is always a problem that haunts philosophy. But I'd like to ask, how can philosophy for a prisoner help understand the experience of what they're living, basically? I think that's not really a question so much as an invitation to talk about it some more.
Yeah, my way into facilitating I ended up facilitating a discussion group with men on death row at Riverbend Maximum Security Prison in Nashville. And that was, there was a circuitous path to that particular form as well. So I had initially volunteered to facilitate a reading group with men that I had met by kind of sitting in on or being an outside student in a minimum security prison class on restorative justice. And so I had connected with some people on the inside there. And Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow had just come out. And a lot of the people who were in this minimum security prison were there on drug-related charges. And so we were talking about that and together proposed this idea of doing a reading group on The New Jim Crow, which, to my surprise, the prison approved. What I didn't know at that time was that the state was built, well, actually, CCA, Corrections Corporation of America, which is the largest prison, private prison company in the United States, and it's headquartered in Nashville. So they were already planning, and they had already signed the preliminary contracts to build a medium security prison about 50 miles from Nashville at the foot of a nuclear reactor that had been decommissioned and had never been operational. This minimum security prison in town and a medium security prison that it was connected to both shut down. One thing led to another, and it turned out that a chaplain at the maximum security prison was wanting to expand programs that were non-religious or more expansive than Christian Bible study in the death row unit. And so she invited me to come and facilitate a discussion group there. But that really felt like jumping in the deep end. I didn't know what does it mean for people in prison to do philosophy. How is it good for them, or what, you know, how do they connect with that? And that's, it felt to me an even huger question. How do people who are on death row, condemned to death, what do they want to read or talk about? How do you begin a conversation? How do they experience their time? And what right do I have to just kind of come in without any knowledge or familiarity and say, hi, everybody? And so I felt daunted by all of that, but also felt like if the invitation was there, I certainly wasn't going to say no. I was just going to try to go and meet the people who were there, and together we would figure out what made sense for them to do, to spend our time once a week, between 2.5 and 3 hours a week. So what we ended up doing was not a class in the sense of, hi, I'm the teacher, I'm going to teach you about Plato or Bentham for that matter. Some of the guys on the inside would have liked that, but they would have liked that if they could have earned credit at the university. You know, simply to do a class for your own edification, but have it be structured in a hierarchical way. And so what we did instead was say, okay, let's think of this as a discussion group, but also a kind of interface between life on the inside and life on the outside. And so over the years, we ended up designing this format where every second week we would break into what we called subcommittees, or small groups that were focused on particular issues that the men inside identified as important to them. So one of those was domestic violence. Another was the school-to-prison pipeline, or trying to stop the criminalization of young people and the funneling into juvenile detention and prison. Another was prison medical care, death penalty law, and LGBTQ issues. And so we alternated between kind of having a theme for a semester and reading books that were shorter texts that were of mutual interest. And so we decide that at the beginning of the semester. And then every second week working in this more, I hesitate to say activist because that's a dirty word in prison, but more community-oriented advocacy way on these issues. And some of the things that we did in that regard are we facilitated communication between the men inside and groups, activist groups or advocacy groups on the outside that worked on issues like domestic violence in the school-to-prison pipeline. We put together presentations that we then gave in conferences and also in community groups and church groups. and we made pamphlets. So we ended up calling our group Reach Coalition, which we saw both as a verb to reach into the prison and to reach out of the prison, but also it became an acronym sort of after the fact, standing for Reciprocal Education and Community Healing. And so every time we were sort of losing focus and trying to think, what is it that we're doing? Why are we doing this? What direction do we want to go in? We would come back to that, okay, reaching in and reaching out, and also reciprocal education, this idea that everyone has something to teach and everyone has something to learn, and community healing. How do we, when someone has committed an act of interpersonal violence that has taken the life of someone else, what does it mean for the community and the individuals intimately involved in that to heal and to become capable of a future that isn't an endless repetition of that violence, but also in a community where the state executes people? What does it mean to heal from or transform the assumption that state violence makes us safer as a community?
The one thing I wanted to ask about, too, is I think you're working on a new project or book about the connection between settler colonialism, incarceration, and reproductive politics.
Yeah.
Those are a lot of big concepts, but maybe we could talk a little bit about that. And especially in light of, I know it's a multi-country study, but Canada, those are intimately connected, I think, especially given the stories in the news and Canada 150 in the last year or so.
Yes. Yeah. Just as my work on solitary confinement and on the death penalty and on mass incarceration in the U.S. grew out of basically my lived experience and the feeling of a deep contradiction between doing work that I love, teaching philosophy, and living in a place that was so dramatically structured by racial inequality and class inequality. So moving to Canada and having this opportunity to come to Queens and to really focus my research on critical prison studies and political philosophy, given that it had moved there over the 10 years that I lived in the United States, this has also meant that I need to respond to this new but also old geopolitical location of Canada. So I grew up in Canada. I did, all of my education in Canada. My prison education, my education in prison issues happened in the United States. Mm-hmm. And so moving back to Canada has, in really important ways, challenged me to think about the history of incarceration here and the very pressing issue of Indigenous over-incarceration and Indigenous deaths in custody in the context and the connections between settler colonialism, which is a history in Canada and also in the United States, but is not really part of the conversation about mass incarceration in the United States. And so moving to Canada has opened up a new way for me. I mean, it's new for me. It's not new in the world of thinking critically about prisons and the continuity, but also some of the changes and breaks between the colonization of what we now call Canada, the reservation system, the residential school system, the pass system, and the criminal legal system that today operates under putatively race-neutral or non-racialized forms of punishment, but nevertheless captures a vastly disproportionate number of Indigenous people in its networks. So thinking about that history is both reconnecting me to my own social position as a settler also making me rethink and understand that, well, but I was a settler in the United States too, and I was a settler in New Zealand too, and I need to rethink for my own sake, but also I think this is an important intellectual project and political project to make those connections between the relationship between settler colonialism, other forms of racial domination, or specifically racial domination that have taken different forms in each of these countries, and incarceration. So it's a big project.
I hope that you take this personal. You know what you did was so hurtful. I cried and I tried, gave you my everything and you lied. Swept me off my feet. You were so brave. Ooh, you made me weak. Loving you was such a fight.
That I would love to talk about is so now that I'm in Kingston, I've only been here for about 2 months so far, but I am really looking forward to connecting sort of more deeply with activism and community education around prisons here in the Kingston area and in Canada more broadly. And I've started meeting with a group that has been meeting for about 2 years so far, called the Prison for Women Memorial Collective. And this is a group of women who were incarcerated in P4W, the Prison for Women, and who want to create a memorial garden about 12 feet by 12 feet to remember the lives lost and the lives lived in that institution. And so Queen's University bought the prison about almost 10 years ago. So we're beginning to deepen the conversation about with Queen's about the accountability that flows from that decision to buy the prison for women, which is not just a neutral piece of real estate and can't be treated as such, and what it would mean to honor that site, which is a site of suffering and violence and death, and also the building of connections and solidarity among women. And one of the things that we've been talking about is, and looking for models for how sites like this, where so much suffering and so much violence has happened, what do we do with these places? Mm-hmm. They're in our midst. They can become so easily normalized as just like, oh, that's a nice old limestone building with a little tower. Oh, wouldn't that be a great condo or a great place for archives or student housing? How can we stop or arrest or interrupt that tendency to simply normalize and accommodate ourselves to histories of violence and histories in which we continue to be deeply implicated even after those institutions have shut down? And so the women who survived that institution want to create a place where people can reflect and meditate on that history. And it needs to be on that site. It can't be simply a plaque, you know, downtown acknowledging that, oh, there was a prison here once. But there's something important about the materiality of, like, this site, this ground, this building that needs to be honored. And so we've been looking at models of sort of reclaiming and sometimes demolishing residential schools in the wake of that violence and that suffering. We're in the process, and I've been thinking to myself about what we can learn from that process and the community consultation of survivors of those institutions for our own relationship as Queen's University to this place that is now part of our responsibility because we decided to buy it.
But yeah, I'm glad we can talk about it because I know that they spoke as well at the Fiverr concert that took place recently. And her project about Rockwood is another important step towards actually wrestling with these ancient buildings that are not just like a picturesque part of a beautiful town, but are like massive centers of state power.
And, right. And this town lived off of those institutions. Mm-hmm. We have a responsibility both as human beings and also as beneficiaries of the industry and the jobs and the economic motor that prisons generated in this city. And also, Queens is also implicated in experiments on prisoners at P4W. So there were experiments, LSD and electroshock therapy, that were conducted by a graduate of Queen's University, and of course, Queen's is not responsible for everything that the graduates of this university do, but there were also experiments on pain threshold tolerance or pain tolerance that were done in the 1960s by an MA student here at Queen's, supervised by a psychology professor. Even if those experiments were not exploitative in the way that the LSD and electroshock experiments were obviously exploitative and damaging to the women who were recruited as volunteers or as coerced
yeah, how much can you be a volunteer as well?
When you have a very narrow range of choices, then you are not in a position to mm-hmm. freely volunteer or to exactly. withhold your volunteer services.
Better said than I could. And you're listening to CPR, that's CFRC 101.9 FM's prison radio program, which airs every 7 to 8 p.m., and that concludes our interview with Lisa Gunther, the new Queen's University National Scholar in Political Philosophy and Critical Prison Studies. It's a really far-ranging and broad and intelligent interview. I'm so proud to be bringing this to you. And if you want to re-listen to that interview, you can also check out cfrc.ca or cfrcprisonradio.wordpress.com. We'll have an archive of this show as soon as possible. And if you'd like to hear more interviews like this or interviews about other things, we'd love to hear from you. So, here's how you can get a hold of us.